This is the Bill Kelly Show podcast.
Let's get into the election thing. As I say, there are more stories almost every day on this. A couple of days left in this election right now. And there's a couple of stories swirling about Doug Ford and his involvement with his family. A comment that he may have made about gun control that obviously a lot of folks are concerned about. And on it goes. And then, of course, the latest polling. Try to get a read on this. Let's bring Christo Avalos into the conversation. Social Science and Humanities Research Council postdoctoral fellow. He's at the University of Toronto and has his eye on the scene here on Ontario politics. Christo, thank you so much for the time. It's good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you, first of all, about the Ford thing. And again, the polling that we have seen over the last couple of days has the PCs with a slight lead, I suppose, especially when it comes to distribution of seats. But there have been a couple of stories in the last 24 hours about Doug Ford. One of them about some comments that he is alleged to have made about gun control, saying guns don't kill people, crazy people with guns kill people. He's tried to walk back on that right now and say that he's in favor of gun control. But the other one is maybe even a little more telling, and that's the lawsuit that has been launched by his brother's family, his late brother's family. Of course, Rob Ford's wife and others are seeking compensation because of what they say is mismanagement by Doug Ford of the family business, and as a result, the family estate. I know some people want to dismiss this as just family feuding at this stage, but I mean, this close to an election, do these sorts of stories actually have an impact on voters?
You know, I think they do. It's a question of how much. Obviously, some people have already voted in advance polling, you know, so if you've already voted, you're kind of locked in, even if you want to change your mind. But, you know, a lot of people still haven't voted. You know, a lot of people really are paying attention right now. We're late enough in the election where it doesn't necessarily look like there's going to be a lot of new news. So, you know, this could be in the voters' minds from now until they mark that X on the, on June 7. And in terms of, you know, if it'll matter, you know, in some ways, Ford's been relatively lucky or skilled, what have you, to get beyond some of these scandals like that around the 407, where, you know, again, as a reminder, up to 30 PC candidates may have used stolen data and fraudulent memberships to win their nomination, and where we don't know yet if that was that information could have been used to help Doug Ford become PC leader. That story has seemingly not hurt him, but this is different because, you know, Rob, I think, or Doug, sorry, is where he is because he's capitalizing off the tragedy of his brother. That's my personal view. Doug isn't there based on his own merits, in my view. I really don't believe that. And I think that when he attacks his brother and his brother's widow and therefore his brother's children, I think that could hurt him with a lot of loyal conservatives who saw him as Doug's brother. Or Rob's brother.
Well, he was his wingman, essentially, wasn't he, Christo?
Yeah.
I mean, Doug Ford's political experience, as we've talked about on the program, is really just one term on Toronto City Council, 1 4-year term. Yeah. And we know about that record, that he was absent for about half of the votes on issues. But his, let's face it, his popularity is based on the fact that he basically was there to try to defend his brother with some of the antics that his brother was involved in.
Yes, and his brother, again, was much more likable. Even if you disagree with him, people, I guess, maybe saw him as more sincere, less cynical, and, you know, maybe that matters. And again, I think that the legacy here, you know, that he's doing this and he's doing it for his brother's legacy to a certain degree. You know, he would often talk about his brother, then look up to the sky, and he's summoning that emotional connection from a lot of, you know, Rob Ford supporters into this campaign. And then when you try to leverage that, meanwhile, you're allegedly, of course, this is not, you know, this is still before the courts, allegedly pilfering Rob's widow and his children. You know, that's not going to look good for a lot of loyal, you know, Rob Ford supporters.
I mean, let's face it, the legacy that Doug Ford is trying to run on here is really his brother's legacy. Even the book that he came out with called Ford Nation. Ford Nation was Rob Ford's nation. I mean, Doug was late to the party on that. That was Rob Ford. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I've talked to some Toronto politicians of all political stripes, Christo, and I'm sure you have. And they were amazed at the popularity that Rob Ford had, even if they disagreed with his politics. And there was a lot to be concerned about his personal behavior. But at the same time, there was a charisma that he had with people of all different types in Toronto. Doug Ford is trying to obviously jump onto that right now, but a story like this basically breaks that connection between the brothers.
Yeah, certainly. Now, of course, we don't know if it's going to work. We don't know if PC, on social media yesterday when I was tweeting about this and other issues, a lot of Ford supporters, were attacking Renata Ford for having substance abuse problems and saying she was being opportunistic and all of this. And, it could be the case that a lot of the people that are going to vote for Ford are going to vote for him anyway, and they're going to, say this is a conspiracy by the Liberals or the NDP to hurt the Ford government. We don't know. But what we do know is that if the general polls are to be believed, this election is basically tied. The Conservatives have a bit of an edge based on their distribution of vote. But if this election is basically tied and it swings a little bit of Conservatives to the NDP, and, we have a high proportion relative to most elections of undecided voters. And if those undecided voters decide to go a little bit heavy in one direction over the other, and this story, the gun control story, other things like that play a role, this could lead to a bit of a surprise on election night.
Well, that's what I'm looking for. And when, with the story I broke about the lawsuit against Doug by Rob Ford's wife, I wonder about the GTA itself, because the polls I'm seeing here, Christo, seem to indicate that whatever edge the PCs have over the NDP this late into the campaign, it's in the GTA. It seems to be within those 45 or 50 seats in the Toronto area and some of the surrounding ridings around there. And that's where Rob Ford's support really was. And obviously the PCs were counting on that. But with this story, I guess the question we're asking ourselves right now, will some of those quote-unquote loyal Rob Ford supporters that were willing to show some love to his brother, will they change their mind now? Because obviously it looks like they've thrown Rob Ford's family under the bus. At least that's what the lawsuit alleges.
I mean, that's a great point. I mean, right now, again, the polls that have it tied, some polls have the NDP up a bit, some have them down a bit over the Conservatives. But you're right. In the polls that have them tied, the reason why people are projecting a Conservative majority still is, their strengths in rural Ontario and their strengths in suburban kind of Ontario, the northern parts of the GTA, much of the 905, excluding like Hamilton and Brampton probably. That's where the Conservatives have a good vote distribution. It's also, in to a certain part, where Rob kind of was very popular and where he, had an influence as mayor, of a lot of those areas. And even if he wasn't formally governing a lot of those areas, he captured the discontent, if you will, of the suburbanites in relation to the downtown Toronto elite. And whether that's a fair characterization or not, he was able to marshal that. And if this does play a role, you have to feel like the greatest impacts will be in areas where Rob had an impact, where Rob himself had a kind of a political impact. I don't know if this will, for instance, hurt the Conservatives in rural eastern Ontario. I don't think that's necessarily going to matter. You're right. If this does have an effect, look for it in some of those communities. Now, it's going to depend. In some of these ridings, the Conservatives have quite substantial leads. Even if they lose 10% in some ridings, they might be okay. So, there could be an impact here that may not affect the seat count as much as people expect.
There's a bizarre disconnect here that I see. Just in talking to voters and looking at some of the polling results, Christo, and I'd like to get your read on this. You look at the two front runners right now, the PCs and the NDP, and I think there's a consensus among people that are wavering. I don't mean the solid supporters that always vote Conservative, because they're going to do that no matter who the leader is. But I've heard some legitimate concerns from Conservative supporters that say, look, we sort of like the team, but we're not crazy about the leader. And then you've got the NDP, and it's actually the inverse of that. Andrea Horvath's popularity is well stated at this stage, but even NDP supporters have some very serious concerns about the team behind her.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some of that, especially the former, the concerns about Ford, the reality that, a lot of Conservatives at local levels, you hear this anecdotally, going door to door when hearing concerns from voters about I don't want Doug as premier. Well, their only narrative is to either run a campaign not mentioning him, or note things like, well, if you elect me, I'll keep an eye on Doug, which I don't know if that's going to work. In our very strong system, the leader has, in a majority government, immense power. There's no really keeping check on him from within your own caucus. And the inverse, I've heard some of that. I think a lot of the critiques of the NDP are overblown, and I think they're somewhat hypocritical. You see a lot of conservatives, for instance, saying that, you know, it's the problem with government today is that it's run by the downtown Toronto elites, not the regular folks like you and me. Yet the NDP is running a series of regular folks. They're running teachers. They're running trade union activists. They're running regular people. They're running some people who would identify as poor people. And, you know, I think that's telling that they're running a slate of candidates that's very diverse, that has, you know, captures the spirit of the province. And again, the conservatives, you know, while trying to be populist, have often critiqued those people for not being, you know, private school educated. A lot of people who have said that, you know, the downtown elites are the issue are now touting Catherine Mulroney as a good conservative, which I think is quite hypocritical. She's, if anything, the epitome of privilege.
But the concerns that I've heard about the NDP are simply saying, look, if Andrea Horvath were to form government, yeah, we like Andrea, you know, she's very popular, been around for a while now. But, and this is where the PCs, I think, are jumping in, and you've seen the reaction to this, Christo. Well, who's going to be the finance minister? Who would be the economic development minister? Who would be the trade minister? They don't see anybody there who's qualified for those. And Ms. Horvath has been asked about that and really hasn't had much of an answer for it so far.
Well, you know, I think on some of those issues, you don't show your cards right away. You know, no government always makes a, you know, a direct announcement of what their cabinet will be prior to elections. You might give hints, but it's something that you do after. Of course, Justin Trudeau didn't pre-announce his cabinet, didn't say we will have, you know, this many people in this many positions necessarily. I think on some of those issues, I think that's traditional bias against the NDP. No one asks, for instance, who would be Labour minister, who would be minister for healthcare in a Conservative government when, you know, their plan is to, you know, curtail labor rights and their plan is to cut social spending and find efficiencies that may or may not exist and don't even have a platform. And so I think that a lot of that is traditional bias. And I think that, you know, in terms of finance ministers and in terms of trade ministers, you need only look at two governments right now in BC and Alberta, the two hottest growing economies in the country. And in many ways, the candidate slates in BC and Alberta were similar to the NDP here, which is to say a lot of regular working class people. And yet those people have done admirably at their job. Alberta, despite an oil crisis, is again the fastest growing economy in the country, or rivaling that of BC, another NDP government. And again, those governments are staffed by regular working class people. They're not from private schools. They're not from the economic elite. And things are going well in those provinces. And you know, things in Ontario, with a government full of the best and brightest, so to speak, from Bay Street, isn't doing so well.
Interesting, now that we're in the last 48 hours, and I guess the overriding concern that all the parties have at this stage, especially the two that are hoping to form a government right now, is at this late stage, I think you were bang on at the beginning of our conversation, Christo, you're not going to hear much in the way of policy that's going to sway people one way or another. I think they've pretty much decided. But some people vote for the most bizarre reasons. They just don't like the look of somebody, something about the personality of somebody else that will sway them and say, okay, I'm not going there, I'm going to go someplace else. We've certainly seen that with Kathleen Wynne. And I guess what we're wondering now is whether or not that's going to manifest itself with somebody choosing between a Doug Ford and an Andrea Horvath.
No, certainly. I mean, you know, policy matters. I think it does. I think that, you know, the Conservatives might still win this, but, you know, let's not forget that they were at near 50%, you know, back when they had a credible policy and a much less controversial leader. And now they're at risk of losing this still. They're probably going to win if you look at the odds, but they're at risk of losing this. So policies matter. But at this stage, you're right in saying that, you know, a lot of that's already happened. There's not going to be any new policies, probably. So it's going to be based on those last-minute emotions. And for those undecided voters or those leaning voters, you know, anything could move them, anything at all. It could be the last thing they read before they came into the polls. It could be, you know, gas prices. It could be, frankly, they've even done some studies that said the way where your name is on the ballot affects your chances of getting a higher vote.
Oh, yeah.
People with the first letter, with the first alphabetically, has about a 1% extra bump, all things else considered, in getting the vote. So if your last name is Zimmerman, you might be in trouble. You know what I mean? Like, you might lose a percent based on that because, you know, your last name starts with Z We don't know. At this point, in a close election, anything like that could matter. And that could hurt Ford, maybe, because Ford has a lot of, he's not generally well-liked. A lot of the base concerns about the party are still there. And there's a general kind of, you know, desire for change, yes, but there's three parties that kind of all don't want Ford as leader. And we don't yet know, the polls haven't really moved much, but we don't yet know the extent to which there might be a last-minute strategic surge against Ford. And if that does happen, it could happen on the last day. A lot of Greens might say, look, I love the Green Party, but, you know, this is too important. I'm going to get behind Andrea, my local NDP candidate, to see if we can stop Ford. And with Wynne's concession, you might see that as well in some parts of Ontario. And that might not get reflected in polls, because that might be a decision people make the night before the election or the day of the election.
Christo Avalos from the University of Toronto. Always a pleasure, Christo. Thanks so much for this.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
Well, as we head to the polls on Thursday in the provincial election, certainly a lot of speculation about who's going to vote, who's not going to vote, and who's going to get the support. And at this point, of course, a lot of the pundits are breaking this all down. Well, there's this demographic. What about this ethnic group? How are they going to support? And on it goes. But there's one demographic group that could actually swing this election one way or another, and that is the young vote, that 18 to 24 group. Of course, many of them are students. And with the election just days away, how do the political parties engage students and encourage voting? It's been a problem, actually, getting that demographic, that age group, out to vote one way or another in these sorts of elections. Joining us to talk about this is Steph Bertolo, who is the VP of Education at McMaster University Student Union. Steph, thank you so much for the time. It's great to have you with us today.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Let me ask you about the attitude right now with an election coming on. It's usually the last week or so that there's a buzz that starts to come on there. People start paying attention. Let's talk a little bit about that demographic and their engagement in this. Do you feel any sense at all that people are talking about it, that they're looking at this?
Yeah, I definitely do. I feel that so through McMaster, the Student Union, and USA, we've been running two campaigns. The Mac Votes campaign and the USA Votes campaign, and through this we've seen consistent student engagement with the upcoming election. I'm aware of students, volunteers on campaign teams of all the major parties in our ridings, and we had great turnout for our debate and good engagement on our social media as well.
Now, was this a riding debate then for Hamilton West?
Yep. So it was a riding debate with the candidates from Hamilton West, Ancaster, Dundas.
And I guess the question we have to ask is, what are the messages? What are the concerns at this stage? Because, you know, if you look at the greater campaign, Steph, and whether it's Kathleen Wynne or Andrew Horvath or Doug Ford, they seem to be hammering around at the same points. There's hydro rates, there's taxes, there's tax breaks, the same stuff that we've heard time and time and time again with variations on those themes. But that doesn't necessarily resonate with that 18 to 24 bracket, does it?
No, not necessarily. We do hear a lot about that, especially in debates, like the leaders' debate. Thankfully, our debate on campus definitely focused a little more on student issues, so we got a good sense of what the parties were talking about, and we're seeing on their platforms that they are considering the cost of education, which is a big concern for students, like the cost of education. We're also very concerned about interregional transit, the environment, social policy, and the economy. So while we're very focused on university issues, we're also looking at a lot of issues that pertain to the entire population as well.
And by the way, these are legitimate concerns. I know some people in other demographic groups might just say, well, students, all they care about is the cost of their tuition. That's a big cost for a family. It's a huge cost. And the related issues are things like student debt and the possibility of employment upon graduation, if that's what the individual wants to do, and on it goes. And you know, something, the public transit issue is a lot bigger than many people would think. Now, I know that some political parties haven't made a big deal about this, but that 18 to 24 group is the one that's going to decide on what priorities are going to be in future generations. And transit, I think, is going to play a pretty big part in that.
Definitely. We at MAC are very passionate about transit. We have students commuting from across southern Ontario to come here, and then within Hamilton as well. So we really want to see a strong transit both between cities and within Hamilton.
Now, one of the problems you have in a circumstance like this, of course, and you just touched on it, Steph, is a lot of the students that are attending McMaster in this case aren't necessarily Hamiltonians. Do they still talk about the issues here? Are they still engaged in this, or is this just something that's happening and they're more concerned about where their hometown is, whether it's Wingham or Toronto or Ottawa?
I think they're concerned about both, and they do have the option, if they're living in Hamilton for the summer, to vote here in Hamilton, West Ancaster, Dundas, or they can vote in their home riding. And, of course, the parties are across Ontario, so the issues that we're talking about on campus are definitely issues that people are talking about back in Ottawa or back in Toronto. So I think it's very transferable across Ontario.
Does that demographic get a bum rap? You know, we've talked about the, I think it was 34% turnout in the last provincial election for that group. It would, by the way, it was up 10% from the election before that. So at least you're on an upward swing as opposed to the general population.
For sure. Yeah, we do hear sometimes that youth aren't voting, and why should people care about our issues? But we do definitely in this election have the opportunity to shape the outcome. For the first time in history, we are outnumbering, or the largest voter bloc, outnumbering baby boomers. And we're seeing a lot of Generation Z also being able to vote for their first time. And it is harder, especially with students off campus while we're trying to get the message out. A lot of students haven't voted before, so it needs to be an effort across Ontario to make sure people who are voting for the first time know exactly what they need and are getting out to vote.
You just touched on something that I think is very, very important, and actually that's why I was saying at the beginning of our conversation that that this vote, this age demographic vote, could actually swing this election, because you are the largest cohort. I mean, you've got the power right now.
For sure, and it's really exciting. It's exciting to see.
Because I know in past, when I've talked to students about voting, they say, why bother? We're a small segment. People don't pay attention to our concerns and the things that we think are important to us. And besides, we just get swallowed up by the greater whole. But right now, you guys can set the agenda, and you guys can have a huge say in how this is going to shape up, not just here, but in the federal election next year.
Definitely. And that's what we're trying to do, especially through USA and the MSU. We are raising our concerns to the government, talking to bureaucrats, talking to elected officials about what students care about. And I think it's been really effective. We're seeing it on party platforms. We're seeing the Liberal government in this past cycle increase OSAP funding, transfer tax credits into upfront grants, and that's really helped students. So I think we're starting to see a lot of movement in government, and we're really hopeful that it will continue after this election as well.
How do you, as a student body, with the organization McMaster, with the Students' Union, Steph, how do you get students engaged in this and get those numbers up and get them to register, which obviously has got to be a key factor? You can't vote if you don't register.
Definitely. So we've been doing a large social media push on our platforms, especially since students are away, but they're always still on social media. So we're just trying to get that information out to them consistently, also updating our MAC website, msumcmaster.ca/MACvotes. And that's where we're also putting a lot of information about the candidates' debate, party platforms, and summarizing it in a way that relates to students' priorities, so that they're a little more inclined to vote when they see that the parties are actually talking about things that they care about.
And you mentioned about having the opportunity to have input, hopefully, into the platforms and some of the things that the leaders are going to be talking about in situations like this. Do you feel as if that message is resonating with those leaders, that they're listening to what you're saying?
Definitely. I think that, well, they know that the numbers are there and that we do have the ability to influence the vote. So I think they're taking a keen interest. And these are also issues that affect families. Like you were mentioning before, a lot of families want to help their children go through university. So when we're talking about tuition, we're not just talking about tuition for students and for young people. We're talking about the cost of tuition for families who really want to help put their children through university. And we're also seeing that with a number of other issues. And, you know, parents want to build a good future for their children as well. So I think that we're seeing a lot of engagement with youth.
What's going on generationally? And the reason I'm asking that is because I've seen in the past, and when I've talked to students who have shown an interest in politics, and I agree with you, I think that's a growing number, a lot of their voting is generational. In other words, well, their parents voted for such and such a party, so I guess I'll vote for them. Or do you find them making up their own minds and saying, no, the priorities are different, this is changing times, and we're going to break from that family tradition, which sometimes goes back generations?
For sure. I think students are making an informed vote, considering the amount of engagement we're seeing in our campaigns this year. So I'm not too sure if they are voting the way their parents vote, or if I'm sure a lot of them have decided to go against that and vote for who they think is the best party. Not that, and that could be exactly who their parents are voting for as well, but it might be a different party. But we've seen engagement in all parties, all the major parties, so I definitely think that the youth voice is definitely diverse, and we're supporting everyone across party lines.
I think there's a connection here right now with the understanding that, look at what happens in this election is going to have a huge impact on, for instance, a lot of the students who are at McMaster, even if they're going to be graduating in the next 4 years. Obviously, the policies that are going to be put in place right now are going to have an impact on their jobs, their professional lives, maybe family lives going forward. I mean, you've heard the stories, I'm sure, Steph, of students that are saddled with $30,000, $40,000 in debt the minute they graduate. I mean, congratulations, here's your diploma. Mm-hmm. And by the way, here's the bill for it. And we understand just how problematic that can be. So I would think that, that students would be inclined to talk about some of those issues and whether or not they can get a foothold getting on with their lives, really.
Definitely. We are definitely hearing a lot about the cost of education. In Ontario, we pay the highest tuition. And the tuition that students pay makes up about 55% of the total cost of their education. So we're seeing a decline in the government investments in post-secondary education, and we'd like to see that increase as a student union, and I think students as a whole would as well, because like you're saying, we're saddled with a lot of debt, and it definitely infringes upon our ability to prosper in the workforce later on.
Just as they may look at that demographic, that age group, people in other demographics, and say, well, students don't really relate and understand exactly what we're concerned about. That's true in the inverse as well. I mean, you just talked about funding for universities themselves, and that's an issue that may not be front and center for an awful lot of people, but certainly it is for anybody who's going to post-secondary institutions now or thinking about it at some point in the future, about the amount of money that's available to those institutions. And you're right there. That's a story that doesn't get told a lot, about the funding cuts to things like universities and research and development, which certainly does have an impact on the educational capabilities.
Definitely. And a well-educated society has a positive implication for the economy. It increases our tax base and revenue overall, and especially in Hamilton, we're getting a lot of graduates staying here and increasing talent, and that's only possible when students are able to access university, when it's affordable and when it's accessible.
How active is the student body when it comes to this? And I guess what we're looking at here is post-secondary education and maybe as a grounding for people, maybe even future politicians and the future leaders that get engaged at this university level or college level, whatever the case might be, and decide that they want to stay engaged in the political realm and actually maybe get into it in some shape or form. I'm sensing that there's a movement, just looking at some of the people that are involved in this election, not necessarily at the leadership level, but within the parties themselves, that they are embracing this younger cohort right now as the future of their party.
Definitely. And I definitely think we see a lot of engagement on campus. We have a very active student council, which is called our Student Representative Assembly. And then we have students engaging with the student union in all aspects, whether through our services or even just attending our concerts. And they're getting engaged in the student union, which really sets them up to hear about a lot of the political issues that we're talking about. So I think, and I agree, I think parties are beginning to see youth as a major influencer. And we're seeing a lot of students on campaign teams who are younger and who have been engaged in student politics on their campuses. And you can just hear it from the way the party leaders talk or the candidates talk in each riding, that they're listening to the youth and they're listening to what matters on our campuses and really incorporating that into their dialogue.
This is almost a perfect storm of engagement, though, for students and for people in this 18 to 24 demographic when you look at it, Steph. Obviously, there's the provincial election coming up in just a couple of days. There's a municipal election in just a couple of months, in October, of course, and students need to be involved in that because some of the same issues you've talked about, those filter down onto the municipal tax base and the municipal concerns, but certainly have an impact on students. And then you got a federal election. So this is not only the most powerful and the largest number of eligible voters in this country right now, but one that really can wield the power. I mean, you can go a long way towards shaping all three levels of government here in Ontario in the next 12 months.
I know, it's really exciting, and I have two elections in my term, which is pretty rare for a vice president of education, but I'm really excited, and municipal politics is something that I've been passionate about for a number of years, so I'm really excited to help students get out to vote in that election as well, and then the federal election next year will be for my successor to lead, and I'm sure we'll see consistent engagement there like we did in the last federal election.
How'd you get involved in this? I mean, you certainly have a passion for this. When did that develop?
Yeah, so I'm from Hamilton, so I think I really started to become passionate about municipal politics because it was affecting my daily life, and my parents are always talking about municipal politics as well on a very surface level, but it still is something that they were impacted by. So I became more engaged in it, especially with the LRT project, where we heard a lot of buzz about that, and the student union was really becoming engaged in the LRT project, and we really wanted to see it move forward. So I think that's where it began, and then it just continued, and now I'm in this role where I'm engaging with government on a regular basis, which is exactly what I love to do.
Are they returning your phone calls?
They are. They are. They are always very excited to talk to either the McMaster Student Union or the Ontario Undergraduate Student Alliance, which is really great, and it's great to know that student voices are heard.
Because the biggest mistake they could make, obviously, to be patronizing and say, well, it's not cute, the student union is calling. But, I mean, with the power of this voting bloc right now and with a knowledge of the issues, you would like to think that they're going to stand up and pay attention to what you're saying.
Definitely. And I think we are. We don't really go into meetings and feel patronized. I think we are very much treated like a major stakeholder, which is exactly what we want to see.
So where do we go from here with this sort of thing? And I guess maybe where does Steph go from here? I mean, you sound like this is something. What are you taking at university right now?
So I'm actually graduating on Tuesday.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm graduating from the Arts and Science program at McMaster. And then I'm doing the Vice President Education role for a year. And then after that, I'm likely doing my Master's in Public Policy.
It sounds like you're leaning towards a life in politics, either politics or policy in some way, shape, or form. You don't have to run for office to be engaged in politics, obviously.
Definitely not. And I guess that relates exactly back to what we're talking about and getting out to vote. It's the perfect way to be engaged in politics as well. And if students are interested, they can definitely check out our websites, msumcmaster.ca/macvotes and usavotes.ca, and of course the Elections Ontario website.
I got a feeling you're going to hear a lot more from you, and not just in the next couple of elections, but maybe in the next few years. Obviously, this has become a passion for you. Listen, I hope it rubs off on more and more students, and I hope that we get that turnout. 34% is not great, I get that, but it's a lot better than it has been traditionally. And I'd like to think that with the conversation that's going on right now, and education does seem to be a key plank in all three political party platforms at this stage, that's going to engage and hopefully motivate more and more students at the university and college level to get involved and to actually have their say in who they'd like to see happening, what happening, and when it comes to this election.
For sure. I think it will. And I think we'll definitely start to see the 34% increase, especially with this election and probably elections to come.
Steph, thanks so much for the time and good luck with this.
Thank you.
Take care. Steph Botello, of course, Vice President of Education at the McMaster Students Union. Go to the webpage if you're a student at Mohawk, their webpage, Redeemer, any one of those. And it is important that this group, which is the largest voting bloc in the province right now, has their say. And because a lot of the issues that we've talked about here are relatable. And I think, you know, I think it'd be a huge mistake to simply indicate, well, they're students, they don't care about things like hydro rates. Sure they do. They understand the impact of what's been going on right now. They see that happening and so many other issues that are going on. Some of them, of course, may not be within their sphere, but frankly, a lot of the issues that the leaders are talking about aren't within the sphere of an awful lot of people when you get into things like this. But they have a great understanding, I mean, at the university level, when you talk to students who are engaged in the political realm, of things like living wages and the impact that that has, and they understand how the impact of poverty can be detrimental to communities. They get it, maybe a lot more so than some of the other people do, and that's why it's important that we have them engaged and have them speaking out and have them voting and having their say in this election. It's an interesting aspect to what's going to be happening on Thursday night when Ontario votes, to see about that age group, that demographic, that 18 to 24 group, and just see if they're going to come out and which way they're going to go, if in fact there's going to be a trend there. That's one of the ones we'll be watching for on election night. And by the way, programming note, Our election coverage on Thursday night starts at 6 o'clock here on CHML with an in-studio panel and some experts from right around the area to talk about what could be happening locally within the ridings here, including a new one, of course, that was given to us in the last reassignment of the districts. And then, of course, we'll kick in with our friends at Global News through the course of the rest of the evening to get the broader Ontario picture. So you want to find out what's going on and how it's going to impact your lives? Election night, keep it right here on 900 CHML.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
The announcement last week by Donald Trump about 25% tariffs on steel, 10% tariffs on aluminum is certainly going to have an impact on the Canadian economy and the local economy. We already know that at the macro level and the federal level, our Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has actually gone on the offensive about this, and he's been quite upset about this. He appeared on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd and has done some other interviews with U.S. media outlets expressing his concern about the trade. Now, of course, the Trump administration responds to that as well. The Prime Minister's overreacting. Yeah, right. Anything like this were to happen to the U.S. economy, they'd be jumping for the highest mountaintop. But be that as it might, there is a concern about this. And then there is the local level. I mean, clearly, if there's going to be an impact on the steel industry, that's going to impact the Hamilton economy. I mean, ArcelorMittal DeFasco and Stelco are the two big players, but there are other steel-related industries that employ people in this area, which is why Hamilton Mayor Fred Eisenberger and the mayor of Sault Ste. Marie, Juan Christian Provenzano, have sent a letter, a joint letter, to the government, but not just to the Canadian government, but also to a number of entities down in the states, 32 cities across the 10 states that are impacted by this, suggesting that they should use whatever leverage they have to try to get the Trump administration to change their minds on this. Well, is that going to help at all? John Best, the publisher of the Bay Observer, has been following this story. He joins us on the Bill Kelly Show to talk about it. Morning, John. How are you doing today?
Doing well, thanks, Bill.
I guess it's the politically smart thing to do for the mayor of both cities to get involved in this and showing that they're rolling their sleeves up on this. But I guess the overriding question here, is this going to do any good at all?
Well, it could. And, you know, they have limited tools at their disposal, but I think this is certainly the best thing they can do. Because we've already heard from some of these communities in the states, in these steel-producing and manufacturing states, they've already expressed some concern that on the U.S. side that these tariffs aren't really going to help them at all. That it's for instance, the example everybody likes to use, the Harley-Davidson motorcycles. The increase in retail price that they're going to experience as a result. So I think it's with the limited tools that they have at their availability, this is probably the best thing they could have done.
Well, locally here, 10,000 steel, this is direct steel production jobs here in Hamilton. We've talked about the shrinking numbers, but that's still significant. And another 30,000 jobs related to steel, that's just in the greater Hamilton area. So, I mean, this is obviously going to have an impact here, John.
It's already having an impact because I just talked to some contacts in the industry, and they tell me that some of the steel finishing plants that are typically shipping to the states have already halted their shipments. So we're in a situation, and you saw this yesterday, where basically the Canadian steel industry is in Ottawa right now, trying to get the Trudeau government to impose our end of the tariffs, because the American tariffs have already kicked in and ours aren't going to kick in until July 1st. And so there's a period here of almost 1 month of exposure where there's all kinds of concerns. Number one, obviously these tariffs have taken place and the shipments have already started to dry up. But secondly, there's a real concern that during this period, we could see offshore, Europe and Asian steel flooding into Canada, and that's a big concern as well.
Well, and therein lies the problem about the ramifications of this. And your point's well taken. I mean, when the announcement was made last week, I like many others, was monitoring a lot of the American political shows and the networks, all of them, as a matter of fact. And nobody's in support of this. I mean, you talk to Paul Ryan, the leader of the Republicans in the Congress and the House of Representatives. He's dead set against this. Senate leaders are dead set against this. A number of governors have spoken up about this, and local municipalities have talked about the impact that this is going to have and say it's wrong-headed. We get the politics of this. This is just Trump being Trump, and I don't mean to trivialize that. But clearly, he is not looking at the impact it's going to have, not just on Canada, but, of course, on the United States economy.
Well, and the irony is, you know, when they talk about Trump, regardless of what he does, so often they say, well, he's playing to his base. Well, if he's in this instance, his base, you know, states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, that's his base, but they're the ones that are going to feel the most disruption as a result of these increases.
But are there going to be political consequences? I mean, because I can tell you right now, he's going to play the blame game. And when, for instance, the price of automobiles go up, or if people are laid off at some of those motoring plants and automobile plants in those states that you've just referenced, he's going to blame Canada. And his base, I'm sure, will simply say, yeah, he's right.
Well, I'm not sure, because his base, a lot of his base are people that work in manufacturing industries. And when they start feeling the pinch in their own plants, and we can't predict at this point. I'm not a macroeconomic guy, but certainly what has essentially happened here is the price of this raw material that goes into so many of our products has just increased by 25% for no particular reason, and it's going to, for the American consumer, to the percentage of any product they purchase that contains steel is going up by 25%. So it's not like only Canadians or Mexicans are feeling the pinch. It's essentially what he's asking American consumers to do is pay more for what? For really nothing has changed other than the imposition of these tariffs, and consumers are going to be asked to pay more for products. So it's everybody's scratching their heads. Nobody can figure out why he's doing it. And I guess the answer, we hope, is that it will be temporary.
John, what about the impact on the... Let's talk about the two big steelmakers here. I do want to make sure that our listeners understand there are a lot more smaller players in steel-related industries here. But, I mean, immediately, when we talk about the steel industry in Hamilton, it conjures up images of Stelco and ArcelorMittal DeFasco. Stelco's situation has been clarified, I guess, now. I mean, there used to be that affiliation with U.S. Steel, and that's over with. But ArcelorMittal is a different situation. They are part of a much bigger company that does have plants in the States. And I got to assume that their cousins down there are thinking this is a pretty good thing. So, I mean, is there a corporate response to that's going to come from ArcelorMittal DeFasco, or do they just say, well, you know, the greater good here is going to go down to the States, and I guess we have to acquiesce to that?
Well, I can tell you that senior executives of DeFasco are in Ottawa right now, and they are trying to get, two things. Number one, they would like to see the Canadian side of this trade war implemented right away to get away from this imbalance. But longer term, they want the federal government to negotiate an end to these tariffs, because you're absolutely right. In the case of ArcelorMittal, there's all kinds of ArcelorMittal product being produced south of the border that they just got a green light. They can raise their prices now if they haven't been competitive in the past with the product that comes out of Hamilton. They now have a cushion that they can work with to make themselves competitive. And if it goes on for too long, then you start actually disrupting markets. You start disrupting supply chains, and then you get into a situation where, Hamilton steelmakers have to start looking for new customers, and the whole thing just becomes a cascade of horribleness.
But the reality here is if, in fact, the Hamilton steelmakers are forced to start looking for new markets and new customers, that's a rather daunting task. I mean, I think we know that on an international level, John, the steel industry is not in great shape and not really on solid foundation. I mean, it's getting better than it was 4 or 5 years ago, but still pretty shaky.
Well, one of the ironies here is that Trump just recently relaxed a sanction that he imposed against China, because he didn't want to see a Chinese company unduly affected and go out of business. And yet the whole cause of this steel issue is largely the oversupply that was created by China. So he's, on the one hand, treating them with a bit of a kid glove approach, when they are, in fact, the reason why there is this steel oversupply problem that's putting all this pressure on steel manufacturers, especially those who are, maybe they haven't invested and technologically their plants aren't as up to date as Hamilton's plants are, and up until now they've been at a competitive disadvantage.
Yeah, and they realize part of the problem, and you know the rational thought would have been and should have been probably for Trump to call Prime Minister Trudeau and say, "Look, we got a common problem here of Chinese dumping. What are we going to do about it?" Instead, he's blaming Canada for the Chinese actions.
Well, he is. He's
indirectly, because he's saying that Canada's allowing that to happen and it's coming into the U.S. market, which by the way is there's no validity to that, but that's the narrative that he's giving right now.
Well, in fact, I think I heard the Prime Minister say that we actually have a trade deficit when it comes to steel with the United States. So, you know, it's pretty clear that Canada is not the problem. We're being punished with a sanction that, by all accounts, both sides of the border, experts everywhere suggest is not a good idea. And so now I guess the question is, how long does it last? Is there a way that some kind of a climb down can be arranged? Can there be some kind of, perhaps a bit of something for show that makes it look like a victory, declare victory and get out kind of a deal? So who knows? There still seems to be, when you read American Metal Market and some of these other publications that are completely up to date, it really does appear that there's still some optimism that they're going to resolve the problem, but the longer it goes on, the worse it is for Hamilton, for sure.
Well, John, let's talk about that scenario, and I hope that's not the scenario that we have to deal with, but I mean, it is, if not a probability, at least a possibility that this could drag on. What about the impact on the local economy? I mean, we understand the numbers aren't the way they were 25 years ago. There just aren't as many people working in the steel industry, but it's still a significant number. And if things start to slow down, you got to think that that's going to have an impact on the local economy.
Oh, sure it will. If it isn't already, I mean, the bite hasn't taken place yet, but if Hamilton steel finishing companies are already suspending shipments, then and that goes on for too long, then obviously the next thing you're going to see are layoffs, hopefully temporary. But yeah, it's I think the next 2 or 3 weeks are going to be critical. Absolutely. And, you know, when you talk about the numbers being lower, probably overall the numbers are definitely lower. But you got to remember that a lot of the steel jobs right now that are taking place in Stony Creek and in these finishing plants, those were jobs that used to be done at the primary steel mills. They made the steel and then they partially or fully fashioned it into where it was heading next. Most of that has all moved off to the finishing companies now. And if you really added up the numbers, I think the total number of people working in some manner in steel in Hamilton is still around 30,000.
Yeah, that's the number I've seen.
Only about 7,000 or 8,000 are involved in primary steel manufacturing on Burlington Street. So there's been a shift. So it's a huge impact. It's still a huge part of our economy, and it's good to see the Chamber of Commerce here and some other people recognizing the value of this industry, because there was certainly a sense for a long time here that maybe this community didn't fully understand the importance of steel and manufacturing in Hamilton.
Got about a minute left, but there's a related issue here that I just wanted to touch on briefly and get your thoughts on, John. And that, of course, is the announcement about Stelco wanting to reclaim some of the, well, supposedly surplus lands that the city and many other people had their eye on as a revenue source. Bedrock, through Stelco, was suggesting that they want to do some expansion. Now, first of all, I'm not so sure they want to do that now in light of what Trump did, but it kind of throws a monkey wrench into the city of Hamilton's plans for revenue generation.
Well, it does, and you know that this is a. If you take the acreage that they're looking at in the Lake Erie, plus what they want to get here, they end up getting something like 2,500 acres for around $45,000 an acre. And it wasn't that long ago that the Port Authority here in Hamilton bought some land down there, and they paid $175,000 an acre. Now, it's, you can't do apples to apples because a big chunk of the land that's being conveyed is in Nanticoke. But, you know, that's a pretty good deal. And as I read it, it's an 8% mortgage on $114 million. So that means there's going to be about $8 or $9 million a year going in, presumably to shore up the pension fund. It's a pretty good deal for Bedrock. And I think the fact that they are talking about perhaps producing primary steel here again gives you some sense that the industry is still thinking these tariffs are going to go away.
You'd like to think so. John Best of the Bay Observer. As always, John, thanks for the time. Greatly appreciated today.
My pleasure.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.